is it Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
He's your host, Lucas Hare.
He's your host, Kerry Shale.
But he's our special guest, director and writer Stephen Unwin.
I lived by the window as he talked to himself. This silence of tongues it was building. Then one morning's wake, the bed it was bare, and eyes left alone with three children. The summer is gone, the ground's turning cold. The stores, one by one, they're a-folding. My children will go as soon as they grow. Well, there ain't nothing here now to hold them.
Steve, that was, wow, heavy Bob. why did you choose that particular excerpt?
I wanted to find something from the early Bob. The really deep rural atmosphere that you find in some of these songs is always kind of gets me. And I think I'm still somewhere a kind of, I'm still drawn to the political Bob is the actual truth of it. Yeah.
Go to the political Bob.
The political Bob, yeah. I mean, I'm your actual Judas, all right. I go, you know, this early stuff is the really, the early stuff and the late stuff is what makes me, you know, howl. I mean, this song, the years passed again and the given was good with a lunch bucket filled every season. What with three babies born, the work was cut down to half a day's shift with no reason. I mean, this isn't kind of American cliche.
No.
This is kind of really deep American poetry.
Mm. He's also writing from a female perspective, which must be quite rare for 1963.
And
there aren't many. I was trying to think of songs on the way here that do the same. I think Angel from Montgomery by John Prine, Free Man in Paris by Joni Mitchell. There aren't many that say, I'm changing my gender to tell you this story.
Yeah.
Certainly not many 21-year-olds or however.
Really? No.
I mean, I have a kind of... I have an increasing frustration with American music at the moment, because I think there's this kind of American mythology, which is, you know, me and my mom and my pop, and we're out in the yard and all this kind of stuff. Whereas this seems to be kind of much, much deeper than those kind of consolatory cliches, if you like. And that's what Times Are Changing, I think, is probably my favourite album, and I just, you know, because you can feel the engagement with a world which is kind of beginning to crumble in all sorts of ways.
When did you first discover Bob?
Well, here's a funny thing. I realized the other day that when I was seven, I've known this for a long time. When I was seven, I went to live in New York. My dad had a job there. I spent 3 years in New York, and so this is 1967 because I'm so old. And we used to go to upstate New York to this kind of place where we used to hang out, which was by a lake. And we must have been there, you know, when Bob and the band were there, you know, not very far away at the same time.
Tears of Rage wafting over the...
Tears of Rage.
Like the Catskills.
Exactly. It was in near Carmel.
Wow.
And I think I must have heard Mr. Tambourine Man and things in those days somewhere. Then the first time I saw Dylan was at Blackbush, which was an extraordinary... I mean, when was Blackbush?
78, I think.
78. Okay, so I was 18.
But you'd heard him...
I'd heard him a lot before that. And you know, I was listening to him as a teenager. I mean, I think I think maybe this album is the first one that I've really got to. And then I think what happened is that as, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, as the new albums were coming out, I was then listening to them without necessarily having gone back through to the really great stuff from the 60s, if you like. I mean, I remember buying Empire Burlesque whenever that was.
Ah, sweet dream.
And you admit it.
I've still got it, man. So it's... the really early stuff. I mean, I love those copyright releases. I still play the very, very early stuff, and I still find it incredibly moving. The thing that I think is really interesting is I think in a way people talk about he's the inheritor of Shakespeare. I don't really quite get that. I think it's Brecht, and it's kind of it's that weird thing about 20th century art, you know, like Picasso and Brecht, of kind of digging deep into popular culture and then mm-hmm. somehow reframing it in a whole new modern way, which I think is what I'm kind of, you know, I love about it.
Are there any of those early songs which you think are particularly Brechtian? I mean, you said to me the other day that a passing comment on John Brown that you said was Brechtian, and I thought we must talk about this.
Well, it is. Masters of War. I mean, put Masters of War up against Guernica and Mother Courage. I mean, and I've followed his coffin in the pale afternoon. Is that the right line? I mean, you know, and I hope that you die and your death does come soon. I mean, I really value and love the I suppose the political energy in it. And, you know, and I know why he can write protest songs all the time. But of course, they're much more than protest songs. They're so psychologically rich. But, you know, when you come to modern times and suddenly you put on Working Man's Blues or whatever it's called, you know, and you suddenly get, there's the same vein and it's coming out. So I've much more drawn to that strand in the work than into than Blonde on Blonde, which has always been the album which I recognise its brilliance, but I don't love it. Yeah. I don't love it. I find that's kind of like, that's all got too much T.S. Eliot in it,
right?
If you like. Whereas this stuff has got more of a popular tradition, got a deeper popular tradition.
And I guess there is a line to be drawn between the early stuff and the more recent stuff in that he's now clearly an old man. I don't think that's an insult to say.
Yeah.
And those first four albums, he wanted, at least vocally, to inhabit the persona of an old man. I mean, you don't record your first album at 21 and include a song called See That My Grave Is Kept Clean if you're interested in bubblegum, you know, boy band pop. So I think it is latching onto the same kind of thing. The Times Are Changing, the song, was written before John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah.
And yet it seems to carry some kind of foreknowledge. And people listening will hate me for saying this, because you'll say you're just reading this nonsense into Dylan's back catalogue, as people like you are wont to do. But he senses something is in the wind. And when he plays that song to Carnegie Hall in October 63, they're still 3 weeks away from being shocked by this event. And there's something he senses in the air.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That Carnegie Hall, that's one of those bootleg box, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's fantastic. There's a fantastic moment in that when he's talking and he says, is this on that album where he says, I got my Bob Dylan mask on, I'm masquerading?
That's the 64.
That's 64, is it? Or I got the wrong date, right. I love that moment. Mm. I think it's very Bob Dylan. It's very profoundly Bob Dylan. Mm. There's a brilliant essay, because I was trying to think a little bit, what do I genuinely think about this weird phenomenon of Bob Dylan? There's a brilliant essay by Borges about Shakespeare. And he says, the thing about Shakespeare is that he's everything and nothing. And I think what it's saying is you can never put your finger on it.
Yeah.
You can never go this, you know, so the bit of Dylan that I love, I really, really love that strand, is only one of a whole load of different kinds of strands, if you see what I mean. I think that's really good about the Borges idea.
Yeah, you said that you like the older Bob Dylan as well as the younger Bob Dylan.
I love
Bob Dylan, who appeared, I don't know, 20 years ago now, or 25 where he's quite clearly playing a part. Yeah. It was around Love and Theft, or at least it was when he grew the mustache properly.
was it the mustache?
I think, and the hats became more and more outlandish. I think he was really going out. You know, he was no longer the rock star Bob Dylan. He was no longer the sort of older, folky, in his garage Bob Dylan. He was then this, he became, the current Bob Dylan's been around for quite a while. The guy with the funny hat, mustache, outlandish cowboy gear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that Bob Dylan, because in a way, he's taken the piss out of being Bob Dylan, or having a costume. Like, he's always wearing a costume.
Well, he's always wearing a costume. And I remember feeling that at Blackbush. I'm like, who is this guy? And he was kind of, I think he had a bit of white makeup on, a top hat and everything.
Yeah,
it was like, it was so bizarre. And he came after Eric Clapton and he just blew it away, I have to say. I love the late Dylan, which seems to me this kind of incredible late flowering. And I think it's Time Out of Mind is the kind of the turning point.
Yes.
And I remember I was going through some kind of crazy emotional upset about somebody. I can't even remember who it was now. And that you know, trying to get to heaven before they close the door, and, you know, I'm lovesick, I'm sick of love. That stuff, that album went right through me because it was happening exactly the same time, whenever year that was. And so suddenly, that, well, not suddenly, but there's a kind of growl in the voice, and I love, probably with the exception of Together Through Life.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm with you.
Ah, silly record. But this
I'll
late...
I'll let that go, because I love that.
You love it.
Yeah.
But this late stuff and this... Telltale Signs is, I think, absolutely fantastic. I mean, I call it... I remember when it came out and I was listening to it and I said, this is music to grow old by. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, this isn't the kind of young howl of rage, nor this kind of deep poetry that we're talking about in... This is music to grow old by. This is really, really profound. Really, well, really profound.
Moving on to Telltale Signs, I just want to... I mean, Mississippi to me is in... For myself, is in his top 20 songs. I find it incredibly moving. I've got it on my actually my alarm. So if I take a little nap in the afternoon, Mississippi comes on, and sometimes I have a little, I feel like it's about life. It's about life and death and regret, and it somehow makes me feel alive. And particularly the first track on the first CD, the Daniel Lanois one, where it's just him and Daniel Lanois, which I think is infinitely better than the one that was released on Love and Theft. I find it so beautiful. The Tool kind of dueling guitars in a way, because you get the feeling that he's trying to sort of screw up the other guy.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And there's a tension in it, but I find it profound. I find it really, really beautiful. I mean, and that song, really every version of that song, and there's three if you include CD3, I think it's got something to offer.
Yeah, it's extraordinary stuff. The song, I mean, there are lots of things on that, but I love Red River Shore. I think it's just astonishing. Some of us turn off the lights and we live in the moonlight shooting by. Some of us scare ourselves to death in the dark to be where the angels fly. Jesus Christ. And then there's this weird thing, I was looking at it yesterday, this weird thing right at the end where this kind of Bible story comes in, a man full of sorrow and strife. Whenever someone around him died and was dead, he knew how to bring him on back to life. Mm. And that's taking that kind of popular, deep popular thing of, you know, Baptist religion. And he's joking about it, but he's also breaking your heart about it.
I've got a question for you both, I know that one of you will have the answer. Howard Hawks made a film called Red River. Where is the Red River?
I don't know.
I can tell you. Because the Red River ran through my town, my hometown.
Right.
In Canada. Because it runs through North Dakota and Minnesota and up to Manitoba. That's the Red River North. There are two Red Rivers. This is what's so confusing. Is the Howard Hawks film was made about the Southern Red River, which I think flows into the Mississippi. But I'm sure that the Red River Shore is about the area that Dylan was growing up, because he says, I've been to the east and I've been to the west. Yeah. And he's right in the middle. He's metaphorically right in the middle, the character in Red River Shore. But he's also literally, I think, right in the middle, because it's about the North Country.
Well, maybe that's back to the North Country again.
Yeah, and effortless segue to Mississippi as well. We're doing very well.
Yeah.
Excellent. Now, there's so many... I feel very strongly that Telltale Signs, when it came out and now as well, it's quite sprawling, and it's, you know, there's a 3-CD version, there's a 2-CD version. I feel, without diminishing it at all, that there is a 1-CD version in there that is amongst his greatest albums. It's so powerful when it hits you.
But I love it as a 2-CD album, I have to say. Mm. Although I know it's sprawling, and I think we disagree about the live cuts, because I love the live cuts. I think every live cut kind of adds to your understanding of the individual track. And I have to say, I've listened to Telltale Signs more than Oh Mercy and Time Out of Mind combined.
Me too,
I find them a little boring eventually. You know, three or four tracks, and then I'll Out of Mind, I'll always go to Highlands. Because I do, a little goes a long way, but this is so varied. That's why it's actually so brilliant because you just, and you know, cocaine comes in concert comes out of nowhere, and you think you're just sort of settling into a great groove of one fantastic, super literate 6 minute track after another, and then there'll be a really wild live track.
Well, also, I mean, I love Time Out of Mind, but I think the weakest song on that album is Can't Wait. I think it's monotonous and it doesn't sound particularly committed. And then along comes this version.
And his agony is just extraordinary.
You know, I think it's more moving than all of Time Out of Mind put together. Yeah. And he left it off.
I actually find, I know the versions, I get a bit confused now because I know the versions on Telltale Signs better than I know the original versions.
So
to me, they're the versions.
And there's a fantastic Ain't Talking on it, isn't there?
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
I tell you what I always want to get is a live version of Nettie Moore, which I think is a staggeringly beautiful song.
Yes,
I mean,
it is.
And it's his poetry is mysterious, isn't it? I miss you, Nettie Moore. The wind, how does it go? The rivers and the rivers on the rise. The winter's gone, the rivers on the rise, or something like that. That is so weird.
It's such a delicate song, though. Yeah. I've seen him perform it live.
Right.
Not very well, you know, because it's like, Miss Humanity, move! It's some nutty, crazy.
I think maybe I've seen him perform it live in London. I tell you something I don't quite understand about Bob Dylan at the moment is, I've seen him lots of times in the last, 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
The part of me won't go back again, not because, not because of the boring old reasons, like he's not playing it like he used to play it or any of that. Mm-hmm. It's because the set list is so predictable. Mm-hmm. And what I just want to go, Bob, just mash it all up. You've got the biggest backlist of any...
Well, he used to.
I know.
It's early 2000s, 2003... Was it when he did Brixton Academy and Shepherd's Bush Empire and Wembley Arena and one other London place four nights consecutively? Yeah. And every night he started with three different songs. And he threw in Romance in Durango and, Heavy in a Bottle of Bread.
He did London Calling, didn't he?
I saw that night, and did London Calling, which was like, what is this? Suddenly, but I suppose that's where... What I find so mysterious about Dylan is that there's this huge sea of originality and of creativity and artistry. Mm. And then at the same time, he also then does this some kind of... I'm just a song and dance man.
Yeah.
And then some of the stuff, I kind of go, like, early Roman Kings. I just go... Really? Can I be bothered with this?
Do you mean musically? I find the lyrics of that really
maybe
interesting.
I need to study the lyrics.
I can't be bothered with most of Tempest, to be honest.
Yeah, no, me neither. But actually, for some reason...
The song I love on Tempest, which I think is a fantastically good song, is the last one. It's the John Lennon thing. I think it's a really, really beautiful tribute.
It's time I tried this again.
I think it's a fantastic song.
I need to try it again because I it seems so on the nose with the docks of Liverpool.
Down in the quarry with the quarrymen.
I think he's just doing something, he's going, there was this other great, great figure and, it's a nod.
I think it's deeply felt, but I've only heard it all the way through a couple of times because I find...
Oh, listen to it again.
I find the beginning excruciating.
Apparently he played it in Blackpool.
Really?
Yeah, he played in Blackpool. I just wish, because of Liverpool. Yeah. I just wish I'd no, I think there's something very beautiful in that song. I like Tempest. No, I'm Together Through Life. I can't really be doing.
Oh, should we have the big Together Through Life argument here?
No, let's not. I don't think it's his worst album. I just think it's his most boring.
I tell you what's the funny thing for me, right? And Luke knows about this. Is I am a massive Deadhead. Okay, I've listened to Grateful Dead all my life, more than anything else. I'm absolutely devoted Deadhead. And I was very, very touched in Chronicles when he says that they got him back on the road and back thinking, and I don't know how true that is, but I was very touched. But it is extraordinary the way that you put them together, and it's a complete clusterfuck, and it doesn't work at all.
Well, I'm glad you agree.
It doesn't work at all. That album is terrible, and I just think it's like orange juice and milk. It's just they're both extraordinary, but they're like two totally different traditions. Mm. One is the genius individual, and the other is the jazz band, which is what the Dead are at their best. Is the improvisatory jazz band, and it just doesn't. It's very, because he then said that he wanted to join them.
Yeah,
it's a weird one.
And I think they took a group vote, didn't they? You know,
and he obviously loved Garcia. I mean, that was obviously a very special thing. But yeah. it's kind of curious, fascinating. You know, these two American icons.
To me, the whole idea of Dylan live versus Dylan in the studio is so interesting because, for instance, on Telltale Signs, the version of Lovesick, I think, is tons better than the original album because it's alive. I feel like the original one is dead. Yeah. And I was listening to it this morning, and there's a great guitar solo in it, and it, that I think just kind of makes brings it alive.
I wish there was a kind of an album of a live album of the last kind of
me too.
10,
I would
10
rather
15 years.
That than have them on Telltale Signs because I think the studio stuff on Telltale Signs is so strong and so cohesive. And that's what's so, I mean, God's sake, it was recorded between 1989 and 2006 and it holds together like it's one album. I mean, that shouldn't work. And I was looking, I was doing some of the maths today on this. This is, and I don't know what this says about Daniel Lanois, but the full version of Telltale Signs has about 40 songs, 9 of them are live. Out of the remaining 31, 20 of them are from Daniel Lanois produced albums, of which there were 2. So what is he saying that he wants to, you know, readdress a different version of this particular aspect?
Well, apparently
of his
they
career.
Almost came to blows in the studio, which actually it just occurred to me as a theater director. Have you ever had an actor who, you know, resented you for...
They all do!
No, let me finish. But resented you for drawing out a performance that perhaps he didn't want to give, because that's what I feel the dynamic is with Dylan and Lanois.
Possibly,
You know, and they got great reviews for it as well. Because I think that's why Dylan resents
Lanois. And that's why he always produces his own stuff now. Jack Frost.
But I'm really interested in the conflict between sort of the director, so to speak, which is the producer in the studio, and the artist.
Yeah. Well, I love all the chatter with Hammond, isn't it? With John Hammond, is it? I love all that stuff on which is that early box.
Are you talking about Bob Johnston, though? Or are you talking about...
Who am I talking about?
Tom Wilson, I think, or Bob Johnston.
Right. It wasn't John Hammond. Yeah. I love all that stuff. I think that's so interesting to getting that kind of... hearing that. And when he just... I can't remember which album this is on. When he just... What's this song called? And he... comes up with a title.
A mule and a porcupine. something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. But it's an interesting dynamic, and it's weird that he stuck with it for so long until he finally thought, fuck this, I'm going to produce my own stuff. But he stuck with it for like 45 years or something.
But presumably as well, I mean, if I was Daniel Lanois and I stumbled across Bob Dylan either during his O Mercy phase or his Time Out of Mind phase, and I had any kind of love for this music, I would have similarly been unable to stop myself from saying, please record this song. This is the best thing you've done in years. I mean, if he walked into the studio and delivered most of the time, like, for example, that version on Telltale Signs, which intrigues me because when O Mercy came out, everybody wanted him to do Blood on the Tracks again, and nobody could understand why he just didn't.
Yeah.
And on that version of Most of the Time, he proves for once and for all that he could have, if he'd wanted to, replicate that Blood on the Tracks New York sound, and then didn't.
Yeah.
You know, and Daniel Lanois must have been going, oh, please record Series of Dreams, please record, you know, Red River Shore, put them on the record, come on!
I think there's a weird thing about Dylan. I mean, I've been brought up probably like you guys, you know, I've got all that Springsteen and Neil Young and Van Morrison and all those guys from all that, you know, all that stuff. And I now hardly ever listen to any of that, hardly ever. And when I put on Bruce Springsteen, I get irritated by it now. And somehow this stands in a completely different place, even though I know, you know, he pretends that they're all his brothers and sisters. Yeah. It's it's a completely different league, I think. Posterity is a ridiculous thing to wonder about. But I think this is weirdly different.
Yes, it is.
I mean, I think people, again, going back to the Shakespeare thing, people say that about Shakespeare, and I think that's right. Is that, you know, Shakespeare isn't just different from Middleton or whoever. It's of a completely different kind. Yeah. It's a different kind of art. I had this provocation when, you know, because like you guys, you know, a lot of people in the world are going, I can't bear Bob Dylan. My provocation is there are 5 great 20th century artists, okay? And they go like this. They go, James Joyce, Pablo Picasso, Samuel Beckett, Brecht, and Bob Dylan. Mm. And what I think is interesting about that, I mean, it's a ridiculous joke, but anyway, I think it's interesting about that is that they're all so of the 20th century. They couldn't be of it in any other time. Yeah. You know, and their work, you know, is entirely original and yet has a complete kind of sense of antiquity and tradition and everything. But they kind of reshaped art in the 20th century. Yeah. And I think it is right in that... I think it's in that... I mean, what does it matter, this? But I do think that. I do find myself feeling
that. Do
you
think it's anything to do with refusing to be influenced by anything other than your own voice?
Except he's influenced by everything.
It's a funny old dichotomy, that.
We're well into the 21st century.
Yeah.
And Dylan is still doing 20th century music.
He's 20th century artist.
He's like, they say, the 60s lasted until 72. I mean, Bob Dylan's 20th century is still going on.
I mean, one of the great things he did is he did the 60s and then he kept going.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
he wasn't lost
by that.
Yeah. He did kind of lock in, though, didn't he? At one point, he sort of locked into that blues groove. And then currently in the recording studio, he's locked into the Great American Songbook groove.
Yeah, I like that stuff, but enough already.
Welcome to the club. Yeah.
Is there another studio album in the works, do we think? I mean, is there going to be a new collection of songs?
I don't know.
Or is it over?
Well, the thing is, we record these things and then they don't go out for 3 or 4 months. It could be that tomorrow.
Yeah, we said something really edgy last week, which by the time we put it out, they'll go, yeah, we've known that for months. What the fuck?
Who the hell knows?
I mean, you hear sort of occasional rumours that he's been in Dublin and there was a film crew and he was... You know, you think, well, what does this mean? Is he doing an album? Because, I mean, for Bob Dylan, an album could be done in 2 or 3 days. Mm. Is he making a video to something? Is he, you know, doing some sort of promotional material for something else? You just don't know.
Yeah.
But the writing is interesting because since... Is Roland John the last song on Tempest? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Since we haven't had a song written by him since then, have we?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Not unless he's done a soundtrack that hasn't been released.
No,
or something.
Not that I can think of. So... While that's not like the 90s when we thought he'd stop writing songs and that was it, it's been a while.
But somebody told me the other day that he actually wrote Chronicles Volume 2 years ago. And it's
all ready to go,
it can drop.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Whenever.
By the time we put this podcast out, I thought
Chronicles was fantastic. I mean, I got it thinking, yeah, I'll read it, but it's going to be, you know. Mm. And I was actually mesmerised by
it. It's like a Bob Dylan album. I've read it a couple times.
Have you?
It's very easy to read again. It's just, you know, you think, oh, I missed
I've not read Tarantula, as I'm sure you gentlemen have.
No, I acquired a copy this year.
I flipped through it at a bookstore once and stuff.
No, but Chronicles I've heard described by people who know about the sources. Firstly, as a work of fiction, but also a work of very, very specific plagiarism. I mean, which interests me.
Yeah.
And I think plagiarism is too weighted a word to use. Alchemy, I think, is the word probably that we should be using, turning base matters into something else. But yeah, so I wish I knew a bit more about the sources.
Yeah, well, you never use plagiarism, back in Shakespeare's day. It just took it, put it on the stage, you know, read some stuff, heard some stuff.
Yeah.
And Dylan's been very open about it, hasn't he? Mm. More than any other person who uses other people's material. Mm. And he's, you know, he just continues to do it, and luckily he keeps getting away with it.
I think that's a fascinating thing. I've always been drawn to and caught by the biblical stuff in it.
Yeah.
Except when he's trying to tell me to believe, at which point I pass me to the sick bucket.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, I listen to that, you know, Red River Shore, and suddenly I go, you know, that line I read earlier, and you suddenly go, God, that's extraordinary. What's he doing there? Yeah. You know, and
but
of course...
it's much more subtle.
And it's really, really subtle. And I can't quite take the religion ones.
No, you're happy within a little hilltop village they gambled for.
Yeah,
like
I'm fine with that. Because that's cultural reference.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's sophisticated. You know, and, you know, all this... Well, Brecht, you know, Brecht was asked what was his biggest influence, and he said, "You'll laugh, the Bible."
Yeah.
So, you know, it's in the same, it's drawn from the same wellspring.
Very Dylan-esque response, yeah.
It's they're these twins. It's very, very interesting, I'm convinced. And, you know, deeply contradictory. And
I suppose
and
if Brecht had been born again, you would have gotten that same.
Well, and of course, Brecht played the guitar. You know, he strummed and played the guitar.
Well, when you and I worked together about a year ago, and that was when the big gospel box came out. And I remember every time I spoke to you, you'd gone from, I hate it, don't tell me to love Jesus, to, no, it's all right. And then one day I saw you and went, I get it. I've been saved.
And then the next time I saw you... I was sending myself up there.
So you're back to the default position.
I can't play it. I mean, I've got it there and it's sat there. This great big box. And I go, I don't know, really. Well, I mean, of course, the Blood on the Tracks box is just staggering. I mean, it's just staggering. It's like watching Picasso sketching or something. And it's like, what the...
it is. It's wonderful. And you, I mean, you're one of the only person I've ever met who invested in the 3-CD box of Telltale Signs.
Yeah, and I love it.
Wasn't it really overpriced at the time?
It was 100 quid or something.
Not for hardened fans like us.
I was being paid at the time. Right. I had a job, I think, then.
Yeah.
And I've got it.
Because it came with a book. Was the book particularly good? I've never seen the book.
Yeah, it's a hardback book.
I should have brought the thing in. I'll lend it to you, man.
It doesn't matter.
And all kinds of shit comes with it. I mean, there is, can I get moments with this? It's been like, we think, how much money do we have to put into his pension? But he's okay, It's proper stuff.
I justify it because I spent over £100 on more blood, more tracks because I got the single CD and the box.
Oh, right.
So I just said to myself, look, I want the Dylan office to know that these are successful ventures and I want them to carry on putting them out. So I'm going to invest in their confidence in future products.
Those CDs has got like 12 takes of "You're Going to Make Me Lonesome When You Go"?
Yeah, you texted me.
I was playing it at home, and Ginny walked in and said, "I'm going to make you lonesome when I go." You play this stuff anymore? I was playing it very loud, and it started. I mean, but it's.
We should give the wives a podcast.
Yeah, we should.
And apologies, Ginny. We're going to leave that in. Funny.
Well, the thing is, when you start, I used to listen to Bob Dylan. Basically, I used to listen to Shuffle before I got into Spotify and stuff, and so Bob Dylan would come on every fifth or sixth song of my record collection. And my wife could deal with that, but now it's just because I'm doing this podcast and because I love Bob Dylan, it's a complete carte blanche. I can listen to Bob Dylan all day long. Let's make domestic harmony a little difficult.
So here's an intriguing thing, that the great big 1966 box, I can listen to the acoustic stuff happily. Mm-hmm. And then I go, oh God, leopard skin pillbox hat, give me a break. Yeah. I mean, there are wonderful things on the electric, but More Blood, More Tracks, it's the exposed, intimate nature of it which really gets me.
Interesting. So you like the fragility. The delicacy,
And that's what I want to say to him. I mean, he's not going to listen to me. I want to say, stop pumping out those... another blues song, and then suddenly you get something like Sugar Baby. Is it?
Sugar Baby on last track on Love and Theft,
which is beautiful, absolutely extraordinary song. Love and Theft seems to have, I can't remember the details, but seems to have 5 great songs and 5 terrible songs. It's probably only got 8 songs on it or something.
I listened to it again the other day.
Which song? I don't remember the terrible songs. It's one of my favourite albums.
There's Poor Boy and there's Floater and the songs about, calling room service and setting me up a room and sitting on my watch so I can be on time.
Yeah.
But I always defend Bob's right to be silly.
Of course.
You know, when you consider the body of work and the sort of songs that we've been discussing... Mm. God bless him for being silly and having the capacity. In fact, I wish he would do it more now. I'm ready for some more silliness.
I must say, Love and Theft, for me, even though it's been a long time now, since 2001 it came out, I put it on yesterday, and the associations of it are still so strong. I ordered that album from Badlands, I'm going to give them a plug, in Cheltenham. They're fantastic for supplying my Bob Dylan albums over the years.
And Bob Dylan drugs.
Yeah, and occasionally they get me the albums early. And I got this one on, I think, Saturday the 8th of September 2001. It was a friend's birthday, and I went off I listened to it before I went there. And so I was still listening to it by the following Tuesday, which was the official release date, September the 11th, 2001. And to this day, I cannot hear the opening strains of Sugar Baby without seeing smoke billowing out of the World Trade Center. Because the image was so associated that day, it's not left me. Yeah. And there are other songs on that album now where I can see myself standing in my kitchen listening to the news.
Yeah,
it was such a specific time. Mm.
I just couldn't get over the mustache when I saw it.
Yeah, no, I love the mustache. And Steve, you were asking me the other day about the inverted commas on Love and Theft.
Yeah, what's all that about?
Yeah, what's all that about?
Well, it's about plagiarism.
Yeah,
it's plagiarism. It's love.
I think.
Yeah,
I think so too. Yeah, I think it must be. It must be. I mean, we've said on this podcast previously that Love and Theft is a rather endearing way of referring to his legacy and his view of the music business and whatever we choose to call plagiarism. Mm. Well, you know, it's a bit of theft, but it's a huge amount of love.
But I think the music business as well is all about theft of money and trust and confidence. I mean, Dylan's, it could be about the music industry. Mm. He loves it, he hates it.
Yeah.
People have robbed me blind. There's a Dylan quote behind that. It's up from Blood on the Tracks. Well, rob me blind, isn't there some...
Yeah, sounds like it's Idiot Wind to me. Yeah, something like that.
There's something... He is so eccentric. There's an extraordinary film of Obama giving in the presidential... And he's like this tiny little kind of totally eccentric guy. It's like... And I remember when you watch him on... You see him live and, you know, he's this tiny little eccentric, extraordinary eccentric figure. Mm. I suppose what must be so weird is having been... world famous, you know, iconically famous for nearly all your life since you're 21 or whatever, however he was with the breakthrough moment. Mm. But it is comically eccentric.
Yes.
There's a thing of Springsteen doing this great long introduction to his... Bob is getting some award. He does this great long introduction. Yeah. And it's typical Springsteen. I don't want to knock Springsteen, but it drives me mad because it's all, you know, I was driving with my mom in my car and then we put on, you know, Highway 61 and, you know, the tears came up. And you can't stop the cliches. Mm. And then Bob Dylan comes on and he gives him an award and he does his little game. And then he wanders off.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, that's the real deal. That's not this ersatz.
Yeah.
Okay, now here's an ersatz story.
Okay.
So I don't believe Tom Waits. I think it's made up.
Ooh.
I think Tom Waits is made up, okay? Anyway, and Ginny loves Tom Waits, right? And I remember saying, I mean, we're playing something. I said, look, it's just like a bloody Christmas carol. The next week, Christmas in Your Heart or whatever that album is, came out. And that was like, that was the biter bit.
Yeah.
Do you know what Obama said when they asked him afterwards, you know, after he gave him the medal? Did you ever hear?
No, what did he say?
Oh, because they said, so what did you talk to Bob about?
Yeah.
You know, backstage, you know, before it happened and everything. And he said, he didn't say a word to me. You know, Obama said, you know, and you could see that he was kind of hurt, but because he's the president of the United States.
He said something about celebrities and they asked him.
But he's Bob Dylan, And, but you could see that he wanted to talk to Bob Dylan, but Bob Dylan would not play that, you know. Game, he's not going to talk to his fan.
It strikes me that you'll only ever have a conversation with Bob Dylan if you forget he's Bob Dylan. I don't think you'll ever get
closer. Well, and you know, Obama would have known that he played at the Lincoln Memorial before Martin Luther King did "I Have a Dream."
Yes, didn't he?
I mean, you know.
It's
interesting to think that the president, who intimidates the president of the United States, Bob Dylan.
But you know what that must, just think what that must have taken for this, how old was he then, 22 or something, to put himself up as a white guy at that unbelievable historical moment and play, I don't know what he played there, I can't remember.
I think When the Ship Comes In.
The Ship Comes In.
Yeah.
Just the
chutzpah.
The chutzpah, the courage, the kind of the belief in the mission is just.
I know you're a big fan of North Country Blues, I believe.
Yeah.
I was watching it the other day on YouTube when he performed it at Newport.
Yeah.
And it was the same sort of thing. It's the one where he asked for the guitar pick beforehand.
Oh, right, yeah.
Borrows this guitar pick, which so it seems totally ramshackle. Yeah, yeah. Then does this brilliant song, and then he finishes it. The audience, you know, they've been stunned. There are people who've been fiddling around because there's other people in the shot have all stopped. People have like stopped with their, you know, they stopped smoking their cigarettes and they're all just watching this phenomenon. And as soon as he finishes the final chord, he gets up and leaves.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't, there's not a second that he takes in the audience response.
Yeah.
And that's quintessential Dylan. He was just a kid when it just happened.
Yeah. The more I listen to Dylan, the more I talk to you guys, the more I think he's so peculiar. I mean, he's such a peculiar, extraordinary, weird genius.
Yes.
It doesn't make it easy for you.
No.
Do you know what I mean? And he keeps changing the rules, like putting out a Christmas album. You go, I was like, you can't. You're Bob Dylan. And he goes, yes, I can.
Yeah. And then occasionally you'll find sort of little clues in his early career and interviews and things that are kind of markers to his later career.
Yeah.
But other than that, there is no logic. It's like when they asked him in 65, you know, if he was going to sell out, what would he sell out to? And he said, ladies' undergarments.
Yeah.
And years later, he does a commercial for Victoria's Secret.
Of course, never you know, put that together.
Yeah. In the Playboy interview of 65, 66, mm-hmm. he says, oh, you wouldn't ask Tony Bennett this question. And you think, what? Bob Dylan talk about Tony Bennett? Makes perfect sense now.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Mm. There's something Old Testament in it. There's some kind of voice which goes way, way back. You know, well, in the Jewish prophet. I think that's really, really intriguing. I get this kind of... The religious elements are very, very striking, I think. They keep appearing, and they're wonderful, except when he starts telling us to believe.
Nicely put. Is It Rolling Bob, Talking Dylan, is recorded in the Anita Ekberg suite at Lip Sync Studios.
Engineered by Brian Gilligan and produced by Robin Guise.
We're on Twitter at Is It Rolling Pod.
Music is by Sam Hare.
Ain't got nothing for you. Had nothing before. Don't even have anything for myself anymore. Sky's full of fire and the pain is pouring down. There's nothing you can sell me. I'll see you around.